You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up on Food Friday, we'll explore how contemporary Mexican food has evolved with chef and PBS cooking host Patty Heenich.
First, with science-y shows like The Big Bang Theory and the celebrity of cosmologist Neil deGrasse Tyson, cultural interest in science seems to be on the upswing. At the front of the science scene, the hit public radio show Radiolab, produced by WNYC Studios. The show is nationally syndicated, explores everything from synesthesia to the origins of lithium.
Soren Wheeler is senior editor for Radiolab, and he recently made the move from New York to Madison, Wisconsin, where he works remotely to shape content and practice the art of storytelling. Soren, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So Radiolab, it's a show about storytelling and it's a show about science, but it's not just a quick hit. You know, here's a guy who experienced this thing with science, but
right.
it's an immersive experience with storytelling. Why do you think that the science needs the storytelling?
Why does the science? I mean, sometimes I feel like the stories need the science. I mean, if it works right, it should be that you hear a story and the story raises a question. It makes you think something, wonder something, want to go check something out. And then, so ideally, actually, it works the other way around. It works that, like, you get interested in a story and then science helps you puzzle through what's going on. So science almost always serves a purpose, or should serve a purpose. There should be some sense of purpose for doing it, rather than just saying, okay, it's science time, you know, which, you know, I think one of the big things for me is, who do you end up getting through to? And if you do, okay, it's science time, I think you've shut out pretty much everyone you actually want to get, you know?
Given that there are zillions of science headlines out there at any given time, what makes the cut? What is it that triggers your spidey sense and says, this is one that could make a great story?
Well, I mean, once again, it's kind of a question of, you know, I wouldn't say that I'm scanning the science headlines and picking the one that tickles me, mm-hmm. because actually what I'm doing is looking for stories that raise a question, and then looking for science to be, I think that's the way to make science a genuine kind of authentic partner in the conversation. I mean, you know, to be fair, I'm a very science focused type person. I did a master's degree in science journalism, et cetera. So I do scan those headlines, and when I'm approaching it from that way, the thing, I mean, it sounds just stupid and simple, but the thing that will make it happen is just honest to goodness surprise first. Like, wow, I really, and I scan a lot of science headlines, so it takes a good bit to be surprising. and then next beat is, does it feel emotional? Does it feel like it has something I can crawl into in terms of character, in terms of narrative? And then finally, does it say something to everybody? Is it not just good information for the people who are researching cancer in mice? No, it's actually something that will make you think a little bit differently about your grandma, or about the universe around you, or about the way we make decisions, or about, you know, like, so it's got to hit me. It's got to be deeply surprising. It's got to have access to some kind of emotional viscera, and it's got to have a payoff.
And you explained this recently in a workshop using Kurt Vonnegut story graph, his explanation of what a story is, the narrative kind of arc, and it turns out it's not really an arc, at least according to the Kurt Vonnegut
of
way
a,
of seeing
a
it.
Wave, yeah.
Yeah, how would you describe that?
I mean, I think, first of all, Kurt Vonnegut was, you know, I mean, there's probably a little bit of tongue-in-cheek in that video where he was describing the kind of simplest forms of stories and a little bit poking fun at how simple they are. But basically, he sets up a graph that has the up and down axes, good health, happy times. Down below is illness and sadness and all those things. And then, of course, left to right is time. And he just shows how every story we tell does this little wave across that graph. It goes, things are good, then they got bad, then they got good again. You know, which is like every rom-com you've ever seen is like, got the girl, happy, happy, lost the girl, said something bad, lied to her, make it up in the end, get back together. And then there's, you know, there's other ones too, man in hole, you know, like going along, something horrible happens, then he gets out. And you can, the curves can get a lot more complicated than that. But the lesson for me there is it is about emotional change over time. Like, so emotions have to come into it, which, you know, I think, as you know, when it comes to science and kind of straight intellectual information is not necessarily, and it's not easy to make that happen. But the key is that emotions have to come into it, and they have to change over time. Something has to happen, has to change. And then you have to, I think for us, if you're then going to bring science into the room and not just tell a Kurt Vonnegut story or a rom-com, then an idea has to creep in somewhere, a question, a thing that you learn, a thing that you see differently, some investigative spirit of curiosity to go dig in and figure something out so that you get, in the end, hopefully, an emotional rush and an intellectual rush. And if you do it right, the two collide in the same moment into like some kind of earth-shattering moment of awe about the universe. You know?
I've seen critiques from some scientists about the way we teach and learn science in our culture, that we've gotten to a point where, okay, we've got this collection of assembled facts and now you learn it, as opposed to, this is an ongoing process. We're not done. We'll never be done. Come engage with us in this process. Are there lessons in the way you're telling stories there that would help move that to the other side of the balance?
I mean, I came from a background in science education, so maybe the lesson goes the other way. Like, I was steeped in thinking about how do you teach kids science for a long, long time, and then went into storytelling. And so for me, the lesson was to see the educational problem first, which, as just as you put it, is that we are, in part because of our testing system, dedicated to making kids learn a list of facts, learn a list of vocab words. And that definitely, you know, get to middle school and start trying to learn the Krebs cycle, and you're going to shut out 90% of the kids who feel like, ugh, why, I can't do this. And not only is it more authentic to the actual experience of doing science, but also it's more effective in terms of keeping people in the room and good education to say, let's go try to figure this out. The answer isn't set ahead of time. Even when you get to an answer, it could change as you learn new things. But the important thing is the question, is the drive to notice things around you, wonder about them, and then take some kind of, you know, series of steps to figure out an answer to those questions, not just a personal answer that's just for you and how you feel, but an answer that you can share with somebody else that makes sense to other people, that has some kind of objective validity to it. So I came out of that world and then noticed that the storytelling version of science journalism was just spiritually in line with that in a lot of ways.
Do you think that there is enough storytelling in the way that we teach science that we get at those moments of awe that scientists themselves look for as a holy grail? The kids get that.
I mean, you know, education is across the country deeply varied. A lot of teachers doing a lot of different things. I mean, there's a lot of kind of standardization in terms of what the textbooks do and what the tests demand of you. And so I don't want to like blanket judge every classroom. But generally, no, there's not enough storytelling. There's not. And I don't know if in the case of the classroom, whether it's a matter of just straight storytelling or if it's a matter of like setting up a puzzle that's actually interesting to your students, that has some acknowledgement of where they're coming from and what they might already think, what they might interest. And I think, you know, that is something that's a known factor in the education world. It's called inquiry learning. And there are groups and teachers trying to do more of that, do it better. And I think that's the right direction to push.
Talking to Soren Wheeler, senior editor at Radiolab, about science and storytelling. And something I enjoy on Radiolab is you start with maybe a question, why? And then you find the answer to that question, but that's another question.
Right.
Why?
Right.
And it, in a way,
it's a little bit childish. It's like,
right,
that
exactly.
Kid is like, why?
You want to discover your inner 3-year-old to get to the answer that maybe the grown-ups are too filtered to ask that obvious or stupid question.
Right. Definitely. I mean, there is definitely an act of trying to put aside that part of you that wants to sound smart, that wants to sort of, you know, pass the test or memorize the words or whatever, and just can't stop wondering and just being deeply authentic and honest in front of people about what you do and don't know. And sometimes, you know, like you as a reporter, you go into something you know a lot, you've done a lot of research, you've done it, and so you have to put yourself back in a place of being like an advocate for the listener. Because the whole game is, honestly, the one thing I think about science journalism in general is it's just a matter of too much of it. And I don't mean this to discredit journalists or writers out there, many of whom are doing great work, but it's just too much of it is just being sent out into an echo chamber of other people who are already interested about science. And that just isn't what I want it to do. I mean, that needs to be done. There, you know, the front page of the science journals need to be out there spreading the news among other scientists, and you want to feed whatever audience. But to me, it doesn't – it just – what we actually need is to get to the people who otherwise wouldn't. And the only way to do that is to take us all back to third grade in some way, when actually most of us really enjoyed science class before the Krebs cycle, before the vocab test.
And it sounds like that makes you kind of vulnerable in the moment, because instead of being like the knowledgeable guy who's hosting or interviewing this radio interview, you're the one who has to ask these really basic questions. I mean, didn't you say in this workshop that your first tapes were you just kind of going, yeah,
Yeah.
kind of agreeing.
The one big point to make is this is largely a job filled with self-loathing. You'll listen back to yourself and just cringe. But that, you know, and that means that you go into an interview with someone and you have to fight every basic human instinct there is in a social interaction about, like, wanting them to like you, wanting them to think you understand them. And you have to get in there and confront and you know, wonder and reveal yourself. So, yeah, it's a deeply vulnerable act. And it's also, if you're doing science journalism that brings emotions into the room and subjectivity and sometimes opinion and speculation, then you are also putting yourself out there in a way that you don't quite know how people will react to it. You're playing with fire in a certain sense. You can't just rest on, well, those are the facts and my job here was to give you the facts and that's what I did. And so, you know, you also are now can be taken to task for being too weepy or being too excited or whatever. So you have to put yourself out there. It is a deeply personal act.
This isn't just science journalism. Does this inform the rest of your life? I mean, a lot of adult life is balancing the fear of looking stupid versus the opportunity to do something new and interesting.
I keep it to the science journalism, and in the rest of my life, I act super smart and no. I don't know. I mean, I think it is just more of like, it's more like finding a way to act in those situations the way you would with your closest friends, with your family members, in that you are naturally vulnerable in front of the people whom you love most, and because you trust them and you trust yourself and you trust that they're going to continue liking you anyway. So it is much more of just getting the formality out of the way, getting the sense of authority, that the authority belongs with one person, getting the sense of performing and coming across as some particular thing out of the way, and just trying your best to be yourself. I mean, of course, inevitably you're engaged in some kind of performance, but yeah, no, it should be that you find that part of yourself outside there in your daily life and bring that into your work. And then you'll sound like a more human if you do that.
So when Radiolab is really effective, when you've got those moments where you've got story and science colliding into this moment of wonder and a new revelation, how do you know when you're there? How do you know when it works?
I don't know. I mean, you are ultimately building something for yourself in some way. You're listening back to it, and you're trying to get yourself out of an analytic mode where you're thinking about worrying as a producer about this or that, and you're trying to get yourself into a sort of a listener mode and just noticing when your body reacts to things and how it really feels to you. And you just feel your way through it. And, you know, ultimately you're doing it with yourself and with a team. So it's when the team all reacts, you get a sense that, yeah, you're doing a lot better. But, you know, you probably make some mistakes too, and other people don't think you quite got there, or they didn't understand the thing, and that's just part of the game for sure.
Soren, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. No problem at all. Appreciate being here.
Soren Wheeler is senior editor at Radiolab. He's currently a science writer in residence at UW-Madison.
Coming up after the news, chef and PBS cooking show host Patty Heenich joins us to talk about her new cookbook. It's called Mexican Today. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.